From the National Humanities Center at Research Triangle Park, North Carolina, this is Wayne Pond with Soundings, conversations and comments featuring scholars and visitors at the National Humanities Center. Studies in the philosophy of mind involve discussion about how the human consciousness operates, the degree and intensity of its awareness of itself and the world around it, and ways of knowing. Some investigation into the philosophy of mind attempts synthesis, the bringing together of linguistics, biology, psychology, and other disciplines. One scholar who recently completed a fellowship at the National Humanities Center investigated the philosophy of mind. She is Lynn Rutter Baker of Middlebury College in Vermont. Part of Professor Baker's research and writing at the center examined the links between moral judgments and ascriptions of belief, desires, and intentions. Here is Lynn Rutter Baker.
Well, actually, Wayne, there's a growing discipline called cognitive science that's a genuinely interdisciplinary discipline that includes psychologists, philosophers, linguists, and computer scientists. Cognitive science tries to look at all intelligent activity under one single paradigm, the information processing paradigm. Under that paradigm, you might consider the brain one species and a computer another species, both of the more general notion of an information processing system.
Are you just sort of borrowing one another's jargon in creating, you know, this new cognitive science, or do you really see some breakthroughs there in the sense that the psychologists are learning something from the philosophers and the philosophers are picking up something from the computer scientists?
I think that the prospects are pretty good for genuine learning across disciplines. That the philosophers, for example, who have worked in semantics and philosophy of language, have insights, not just jargon, but insights that are useful to people who are trying to simulate cognitive processes. Mm-hmm. Cognitive processes must hook up with semantic qualities. To understand cognition, you must be able to put it in terms, or at least at the first level, you must be able to put it in terms of things like believing that something is the case or desiring that something be the case. Semantic properties of utterances or thoughts or inscriptions are those that have to do with meaning, those that have to do with the truth or the reference of a thought or an utterance. For example, if you utter roses are red, Several semantic properties of that utterance are that it's about roses, that it's true. Non-semantic properties that it has are that it is produced by your vocal cords. Your vocal cords were caused to move in the way that they moved by virtue of impulses from your brain. There are two basic ways that language has been understood by philosophers. One stems from Descartes in the 17th century, and the other was at least brought to the forefront by Wittgenstein in the 20th century. In the first, the Cartesian tradition of looking at language, language can be understood individualistically. You can go through the exercise that Descartes went through in the Meditations, where he said, I have a lot of beliefs about the world around me, but of course all those beliefs might be false. And he tried to abstract more and more away from the world into his own mind until he could get to some indubitable fact without any assumptions of the existence of anything. That's when he got to I think, therefore I am. That makes sense only if you suppose that language can be understood individualistically. The Wittgensteinian view is that there's no such thing as a private language, that the notion of a private language is incoherent. Because there would be no, if there could be a logically private language that you, an individual, could have quite apart from any community you might be in, from any practices you might engage in with other people, then there would be no way to determine whether or not you are using the words correctly. If there's no difference between correct and incorrect uses of words, then there's no sense of calling whatever you're doing a language.
Well, I remember hearing something said about him, or maybe he said it himself, something like the limits of language are the limits of life.
That, I believe, comes from the Tractatus. That was his early work. In that work, Wittgenstein thought that the world and language were isomorphic.
Isomorphic. That's a 50-cent one if I've ever heard. What does that mean?
That there's a one-to-one relationship between elements in the world and elements in language.
Uh-huh.
In fact, the first line of the Tractatus is, the world is all that is the case. An intriguing first line. And what's sort of metaphysically basic in the world are facts. What's metaphysically basic in language are statements of fact. There's what's metaphysically in the world, there are objects, absolutely simple objects. In language, there are singular terms.
Mm-hmm.
So that there's a one-to-one relationship between elements in language and elements in the world. That was Wittgenstein's view up through the First World War. And he uses it brilliantly to try to erect an entire structure of knowledge based on his own individual, indubitable experience.
It sounds like Dr. Johnson kicking the rock and saying, that's how I refute the notion of the unreality of matter. Do I have that right?
That's certainly what Dr. Johnson did in response to Berkeley.
Mm-hmm. Lynn, let me bring you back to brains and minds and computers.
We'll have to make some distinctions within the question.
I know
that's what philosophers always do.
Fair enough.
Try to make so many distinctions that their opponents will go to sleep or their discussants will get up and go get a beer or something. But we'll need to make a distinction between the notion of mental state type and an instance of a mental state.
So we're talking now about categories and then specifics.
Right.
Okay.
Right. If you and I have the same beliefs, we should therefore be in the same states.
Uh-huh.
Now, that would be a very strong kind of physicalism. In fact, it would be, I think, probably implausibly strong. It's also not the kind of view that people who rely on the computer metaphor would want to endorse.
Why wouldn't they?
Because computers are obviously not in the same sorts of states, physically speaking, that we are, mm-hmm. physically speaking. So if you have in mind the idea of an information processing system so that computers are species of it and we are species of it, and computers, we can share beliefs and mental states with computers, then you have to think this strong sort of physicalism is false.
I see.
However, there's a weaker sort of physicalism which people who rely on the computer metaphor would probably endorse. The weaker sort of physicalism is to deny that for every mental state there must be a unique physical state, but to say instead that for every instance of a mental state there is an instance of a physical state.
And this is where you fall on this spectrum. Do I have that right?
More or less.
Which position here do you advocate, or are you inclined to advocate?
If I advocate either, it would be the latter.
Mm-hmm.
That is, if I advocate either, it would be the weaker view, the view that when you actually utter, or when the thought that grass is green runs through your head,
mm-hmm.
there's something going on in your brain. When the thought that grass is green runs through my head, there's
mm-hmm.
something going on in my brain. But what's going on in our respective brains need not be describable in the same way physically.
I remember as a student having a talk with a friend of mine who was in medical school, who told me that eventually the scientists and the doctors would be able to look into the mind and see something physical happening, neurons spinning around, these electron microscopes, all of that, and say, bingo, there's a thought.
I hesitate to make predictions about the future of brain physiology or
mm-hmm.
the future of the discipline of brain physiology. I think it's now considered doubtful that you could really look into the brain with something like a cerebroscope.
Right.
And really be able to detect what you would be able to, even if you could detect every neuron firing, every bit of activity in the brain, you might not be able to detect that this is a thought that snow is white. It's these semantic properties that don't seem to fit in with the physical description. Language is a social activity.
Uh-huh.
There's no such thing as a private language. All the things I said earlier about Descartes and about the indubitable given and about trying to erect knowledge on some very sound foundation, All of that is rejected by Wittgenstein in his later view. He thinks he no longer thinks it makes sense.
It's a shared kind of thing.
It's not only it's shared, and it's not an accident that it's shared. It's essentially shared.
Mm-hmm. Lynn, are you simply saying that words have to have a basis in fact, quote unquote, something physical, something scientific?
More than that, on this very optimistic view that beliefs can be intentional states, states with content, states that are identified by that snow is white or that roses are red, that states like that can be incorporated into a scientific theory.
Uh-huh.
That's the very optimistic view, is not just that beliefs have, you couldn't have beliefs if you didn't have a brain, or you couldn't have beliefs if there weren't some sort of physical correlate, but it's what makes this view optimistic is that when you get a correct scientific psychology, you will see that beliefs, as it were, map onto it,
mm-hmm.
in a way that makes beliefs scientifically respectable. I don't mean makes what beliefs are about scientifically respectable or makes beliefs true. I mean makes the fact that you are currently having the thought that snow is white, that can be explained in terms of a scientific psychology.
As well as my own inclinations or feelings,
right,
or whatever.
Mm. Right. Right. What's at issue here is not so much the legitimacy of your belief,
uh-huh.
and it's not so much whether you're justified in having the belief, whether it's true or false, but rather the fact that you're having the belief, whether or not that can be understood scientifically.
Mm-hmm.
Now, there are less optimistic views than this first view, according to which, if we have a real scientific psychology, we'll see that beliefs don't map on to what we know then about the brain and about behavior. In that case, I guess there are two roads you could take. One, the road that I think many philosophers are inclined to take, is to say that therefore there's something dubious about all our talk about beliefs and desires and intention, that all of that was pre-theoretical, they call it folk psychology. And that we now see that should be superseded by a scientific psychology.
Now, you use a term like folk psychology. Tell me if I'm wrong when I say that it sounds to me like you're describing the possibility of different people in different cultures arguing about whether snow is white. I mean, you know, in America, we may look at it and we say, well, you know, in the city, it may be sometimes
right,
kind of dirty.
Never white.
Yeah.
Right.
But on the other hand, somebody who's never seen snow, when first exposed to it, would look at it and say, what lovely green stuff. Is that what you're after here?
We're not talking here about differences between cultures or differences between language. For the point here, if there's such a thing as a scientific psychology,
mm-hmm.
and if
it's universal,
yes, and if beliefs don't map on to the scientific psychology, beliefs and desires and intentions map on to the scientific psychology, then I think many contemporary philosophers are inclined to say that we never had any beliefs at all, that nobody ever had any beliefs at all. But yes, the people who are not optimistic that a scientific psychology will incorporate these intentional states like beliefs and desires and intentions see all of our talk about beliefs and desires and intentions and reasons and action, all of that talk they see as pre-scientific folk psychology, in the same way that they would see Aristotle's views of motion as pre-scientific folk physics.
Mm-hmm, mm-hmm.
And just as Aristotle's pre-scientific folk physics was overthrown at least by the 17th century and superseded and discarded, so too these philosophers suppose all of our apparatus of thinking in terms of beliefs and desires and intentions, of actions and reasons, all of that could be superseded and discarded if scientific psychology came out in a way that could not accommodate that whole pattern of thought.
So which direction, Lynn, is it headed in, scientific psychology? What does this have to do with morality? You're looking at morality. Where do our notions of morality come from?
I'm inclined to think that our morality comes from our communal nature. When Wittgenstein didn't really think of us as, I think, as isolated individuals who happen to have some things in common and find it convenient then to make alliances. I think he thought that mind itself is social, that you couldn't even understand intelligence at all, language at all, except in terms of community practices, or, as he said, forms of life. Basically, morality stems from the fact that we're the kinds of beings that we are.
Let's pause on that for a moment, Lynn. One of the terms that you use in your work here at the Humanities Center, not a term, one of the questions that you're investigating is moral relativism.
Moral relativism, as I understand, well, as at least in some of its versions, is the view that we're not all subject to it. There's no moral demand to which we're all subject, that what's moral for you might be different from what's moral for me.
All these different drummers.
Right.
Okay.
Now that, I think, is an untenable view. There are a lot of versions of moral relativism, going from very unsophisticated and sort of discardable at the outset to really quite sophisticated views of moral relativism. The way I see moral relativism fitting in with the work that I'm doing in the philosophy of mind is this. I'm trying to investigate what implications various views of the mind have for morality, for views on morality. And by philosophy of mind, I mean really the issues that we've been talking about here today.
Mm-hmm.
If you take these various views of the mind that rely on the computer analogy, they have implications for the status of beliefs and desires and intentions, as we just talked about a minute ago.
Well, what are these models? What are these views? I mean, are there, what, a half a dozen, 200? Can you break them down into roughly identifiable categories?
I think there are three basic views. One is that what I was earlier calling the optimistic view,
mm-hmm.
that when you get a scientific psychology, beliefs and desires and intentions will find some sort of home.
Uh-huh.
Or the less optimistic view is that when you get a scientific psychology, it will bear no resemblance to any way we ordinarily conceive of beliefs and desires and intentions. And the third view is really a variation of the second. It is that if we get a scientific psychology that there may be a scientific psychology that bears no resemblance to our ordinary ways of looking at mentality in terms of beliefs, desires, and intentions, but that's all right. We still find it very useful to attribute beliefs and desires to people. It's sort of they're convenient fictions. So we still could say, well, he didn't know what he was doing, but that wouldn't really have any basis in fact. On any of these views of mind, I think all of these views of mind in a way challenge the ordinary person's understanding of the way life is, the way we are. We all have beliefs and desires and intentions. We explain our actions in terms of reasons, and reasons can't be understood apart from beliefs and desires and intentions. So I think all of these views challenge the sort of the ordinary way of understanding action.
From the National Humanities Center, this is Wayne Pond with Soundings. You're listening to a conversation with one scholar who recently completed a fellowship at the National Humanities Center. She is Lynn Rudder Baker of Middlebury College in Vermont. At the center, Professor Baker worked on a project about realism and moral action, focusing partially on the connections between moral judgments and descriptions of belief, desires, and intentions.
Now, it sounds to me, if I were to be uncharitable, I could accuse you as being just altogether too objective as a philosopher, that you are talking at a level here which is so abstract and so distanced from the ordinary concerns of everyday people that I could say, oh, there you go again, you philosophers, you have removed, you've just taken all the juice out of it. I remember there's a line someplace in Hawthorne about where he says that philosophy that doesn't address the problems of its time is no good. How would you respond to that?
Well, carefully. I would agree that philosophy should address the problems of its time.
Mm-hmm.
There are various ways to look at the problems.
But there's a lot of groundwork that needs to be done. Is that right?
But I think one of the pressing problems of our time is is how to understand the mind in light of what seems to be this predominant computer analogy. Mm-hmm. That is, I take this project to be a lot more, I take it to be very relevant to central concerns of contemporary American life, and I think it has important implications about morality.
Okay, so how is it relevant, and what are some of its implications?
If any of these views are correct, that any of the views that we've been discussing here for the past several minutes, if any of these views are correct, I think there's a challenge to our understanding of morality. Because if it's the case that, say, there's no such, if philosophers and scientists are willing to say that there are no such things as beliefs, or beliefs are just convenient fictions, then what does that, that certainly has implications about how we are to understand the blameworthiness, the praiseworthiness, the responsibility of people who act in the world. Certainly, when we consider whether or not somebody should be convicted of some crime, we ask things like, what did the defendant believe that he was doing?
Mm-hmm.
Did he know that the gun was loaded? Did he have reason to suspect that it was a gun at all? Did he know that when he switched the light, it was hooked up to some bomb that the light switch was a detonator to some bomb? If he didn't know that, if he didn't have reason to believe that, he's not guilty of anything. So the distinctions between what you believe and what you didn't believe turn out to be extremely important for making moral judgment, for assessing responsibility.
Now, your comments bring me back to another line that I remember hearing as a student, that philosophy exists to explain evil in the world. I'm not so sure that you'd go that far, but you are taking steps, at least in that direction. And when I say evil, I'm not talking about final dogmatic theological notions of evil, just deviations from normalcy. We're trying to figure out how to account for what we do and how we behave. Is that right?
Well, yes and no. I think philosophy is essentially normative. That is, it's that one thing that would
looks for a middle ground.
No, it's not just descriptive. Any time you talk about reasons or what it's reasonable to do,
uh-huh,
or what it's right to do, you're in the realm of the normative. That is, you're not just saying something that can be testable in some laboratory way.
Purely scientific way.
Right.
Uh-huh.
Right. So that I think what philosophy has to offer is an attempt to understand reason, rationality, meaning, morality, all those terms that whatever they mean, they don't seem to fit easily into a notion of atoms in the void.
You're accounting, in other words, Lynn, for the complexity of it.
Well, at least I want to bring out the fact that there is complexity.
Mm-hmm.
Philosophy also teaches critical thinking in a second sense. It teaches you to be critical of many of your own assumptions. I think it would be arrogant to suppose that philosophers are even aware of all their assumptions. I don't suppose anybody is aware of all of his or her assumptions.
So they don't know the truth, quote unquote.
They're after it.
Mm-hmm.
And they're after it in a fairly distinctive way. And when I said earlier that I thought philosophy was normative, it's also conceptual in a way. It's interested in how we conceptualize the world, how we conceptualize reality. That is, it's interested in the concept of reason. Not just start with some arbitrary definition and then see what fits under it, but how ought we understand reason and rationality?
Do you think, Lynn, that philosophy as an enterprise practiced in the academy, or insofar as it finds its way into the general population, is it palliative? Is it good? Is it therapeutic? Is it something that helps the social fabric? I ask because there are people who say, stay away from that stuff. It'll turn you into a disbeliever. You'll end up in the void. You will despair. You won't like yourself, and you won't like the people you live amongst.
I hope that's not true.
Okay, tell me why.
I don't see any connection between becoming more aware of yourself or your world and becoming more alienated. In fact, I think that's a rather very pessimistic,
sure,
a very pessimistic view.
It's really arcane to a lot of people.
It is. Let me say another word or so about the value of it.
Okay.
The value of philosophy lies not only in the modes of thinking that you assimilate, but also I think that the goal of philosophy is a sort of self-knowledge.
Mm-hmm. So,
as Socrates actually, know thyself, or actually I suppose that was a Greek commonplace, but a kind of self-knowledge is the goal of philosophy, but it's not a self-knowledge in some egocentric sense. It's not a self-knowledge in some psychological sense, and it's not so much knowing your underlying motivations, as it is understanding your place in civilization, in history, understanding your intellectual predecessors, how we got here from there, how did we ever get to the point of supposing that reality was exhausted by atoms in the void. Part of the way I approach the classroom is in a spirit of puzzle and fun, and set out puzzles and see if we can't just sort of have the fun of trying to sort through some conceptual difficulty is not unlike the fun of a chess game.
Uh-huh.
Or the fun of a crossword puzzle.
The Electric Company for undergraduates.
Well, but it has the advantage over chess games and crossword puzzles in that you actually deal with very important issues. That is, the life of the mind, I think, the life of the mind is often underrated, but once students sort of get onto the fun of the puzzle aspect, they often follow right through with the substance, so that then Plato becomes interesting, not just for the puzzles of Plato, but for the sheer genius of Plato.
You say that the life of the mind is underrated. Is that because you can't see it, like a skyscraper or a hamburger enterprise that you open up?
Well, perhaps it's part of our national character.
Mm-hmm.
To place higher value on getting things done, that can tangible things, where at the end of which you have some kind of visible product.
Yeah.
At the end of philosophy, at best you perhaps have an argument or a paper or a book, but as a visible product, I suppose that doesn't go as far as a building or a ship.
But you say it's just as important.
Oh, much more so. In fact, it's the philosophical aspects of life that I think give meaning to all the other aspects of life, that makes it possible to understand why there's meaning at all. Not so much that the meaning is in the philosophy and not in the technology or something. That's
mm-hmm.
not what I, that was a mistake. Rather, it's the reflection, the conceptual thinking that can illuminate meaning wherever it is.
The program is Soundings from the National Humanities Center. This is Wayne Pond. You've been listening to a conversation with one scholar who recently completed a fellowship at the National Humanities Center. She is Lynn Rudder Baker of Middlebury College in Vermont. At the center, Professor Baker worked on a project about realism and moral action. Next week on Soundings, a conversation about historical fiction. My guest will be George Garrett, a professor of English at the University of Michigan. George Garrett is the author of two novels about Elizabethan England, The Succession and Death of the Fox. Soundings would like to hear from you. Send your comments to the National Humanities Center, Research Triangle Park, North Carolina, 27709. Soundings is made possible by grants from the National Endowment for the Humanities.